I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. This is our weekly live stream. The first hour today is going to be me answering your questions. And in the second hour, we will bring in Carl Thorburn, who wrote an article last week called Bonfire of the Shorts, which is a very clear explanation of the short squeeze that has been so entertaining and empowering for a lot of our people. So that is coming up in the second hour. But in the first hour, I'm going to be taking your questions, answering your questions. So anyway, I want to begin by hopping over to Entropy. And Entropy is the platform that allows us to take credit card donations. It's the only platform, actually, that allows us to take credit card donations. And I'm going to be putting the Entropy banner across the bottom of the screen, entropystream.live/countercurrents. So if you go there, you will see a green button that says leave offline chat or offline donation. Hit the green button. You can go leave a comment, question, and a donation, and I will read them and discuss them in the course of the show. So I want to talk, first of all, about a couple of comments and donations that came in since last week. First of all, last Sunday, Unknown Californian gave $3 and left a comment. I don't remember if I read it or not, but I will read it now. I always look forward to listening to Greg on Sundays. Greg is a white pill. One way we gain political power is through money, so everyone donate. I agree with that. Thank you very much. Niels has written in with $50. This is very generous. And he says, there are those who like hearing Greg say Ninjagini. And I can't say Ninjagini anymore because we've been delemonized. DLive will no longer allow you to donate lemons, ice creams, Ninjaginis, Ninjets, whatever, to Countercurrents. I'm sorry about that, but they got squeezed after the Capitol insurrection. And they've demonetized any political channels. That includes us. Any channels where there's adult conversation about politics. So anyway, he goes, there are those who like hearing Greg say Ninjagini. I much prefer him to hear him say, in the name of the great god, Ingwe Freyr. So here follows February's donation given in the name of the great god, Ingwe Freyr. Well, thank you very much. And C writes in with two donations, one of $7 and the other of $3. So I very much appreciate those. And I imagine others will be chiming in fairly soon. So I got a few questions from Eric, I believe is the name, over at Countercurrents. He left them just as a Countercurrents comment. And I want to run through those now. And these are questions that people have asked before, but what the heck, I'll answer them again. So the first question is, am I a coffee or a tea nationalist? Okay. And my answer is both. I start the day with a cup of coffee, and then I have a cup of tea a little later on. And I actually think it's better than just coffee. I think tea, you know, has different substances in it, and I find that the theanine actually helps me with my intellectual work. So do I have a dog or a cat for a pet? Sadly, I have no pets at all right now, but I am going to remedy that situation. And I'm a dog nationalist, I have to say. I don't dislike cats, but cats dislike me. I'm allergic to cat dander, so it's just not a good match. What's my favorite color? Well, I like dark red. I like red walls and things like that. People think that's a little intense, but I really like dark, rich reds. Favorite flavor of ice cream? Well, hazelnut. I'm one of these people who have been cursed somehow, karmically cursed with an allergy to chocolate. It just doesn't do me any good. And chocolate really is in practically every dessert these days. And, you know, I like hazelnut, though. Of course, you get hazelnut mixed with chocolate in the form of Nutella, stuff like that, too. But I do like hazelnut if I can get it in any desserts, including ice cream or gelato. And finally, he asks, what are my favorite coming of age movies? Well, there's only one movie that really immediately springs to mind that's a coming of age movie that's high on my list of favorites, and that's David Lynch's Blue Velvet. And I've written an extensive essay on Blue Velvet that's at Countercurrents that explains how I think of it as a coming of age film. It's basically a film about a young man, a college boy who's called home because his father's in the hospital with some mysterious accident or stroke or something. And he comes home to help his mom and see his dad and discovers that beneath the surface of his small town that he grew up in, there's a deeper level of things, basically a criminal underworld. There's evil. And he's never really encountered this before. And by encountering evil and descending into this underworld of evil and conquering it, he basically becomes a man. And he seems to be on the trajectory of becoming a policeman or some other guardian of public order. And the character of Dale Cooper in the series Twin Peaks, which was the next major project that Lynch had after Blue Velvet, I think is in some ways a continuation of the character played also by Kyle MacLachlan in Blue Velvet. Jeffrey Beaumont is his name. It's the coming of age story for Jeffrey Beaumont, and he seems to be on the path to becoming some kind of guardian of public order. And then we get the same actor and very much the same character as Dale Cooper of the FBI a few years later in Twin Peaks. So I think that that's a brilliant coming of age movie, and I highly recommend it. I can't think of others really that are high on my favorites lists, other coming of age films. So anyway, let's see if we've got some questions here at DLive. So I'm just going to scroll through this. Okay, so I sound good. That's good to know. Video settings need to be updated. It still says Paul Wagner. I know. I'll take care of that later. The first hour is an AMA. Okay, I'm sorry. That's Gadius announcing to people what I've already said. Pastor Lindstedt says he's left a question over at Countercurrents. I'll have to take a look over there in a minute. Yes, another person who's allergic to cats. I like cats. I think they're beautiful animals. They just don't like me. Will Countercurrents move to Trovo or Libri? Well, honestly, no, not right now. And the reason why I don't want to do that is that yesterday I listened to the Writer's Block stream over on Trovo, and our guest who's coming on later today, Carl Thorburn, was the guest there. And he was fantastic. It was a great show, and there were fewer than 50 people listening. Normally, there were three or four times that many people listening to the Writer's Block on DLive. And until Trovo builds up regular listeners and followers over there, I don't want to move. I'm less concerned about getting delemonized than I am losing my audience at this point. Trovo has been working pretty well for the streamers that move there. Well, that's good, and I might just go there eventually, but I'm not going to move there immediately. So anyway, I'm going to move over to Countercurrents and see what kind of comments are waiting for me there. So Pastor Lindstedt writes, now that the dying Zog collapses, what now for Countercurrents? Looking at the past month's Countercurrents, I'd say that of all the White Nationalist 2.0 forums, blogs, and podcasts, you have ascended to the very top of the heap. Well, thank you very much. The 2020 selection was fraudulent and bogus. I'm glad you're on board with me on that. Zog is rounding up the trunk magatards and is fording up its own green zones while the economy is tanking. The oligarchs are getting rich while the Zoglings are being dispossessed, and the Kung Zog flu has morphed into many strains while Zoglings are being dipped with the Bill Gates. He's he spells it Ball, B-A-A-L, Ball Gates vaccine and chipped with the Mark of the Beast microchip. Well, I'm not a white nationalist 1.0, or especially not a 2.0, but rather a paleo white supremacist 7.777 point. My solution to the mighty evil dying Zog Empire is to let it collapse as it is now doing in favor of what I call the 10,000 warlords, which are the inevitable breakup of Zog takes place, coupled with peak oil realities, means that the centralized Zog Empire becomes a local county level theocratic military dictatorship run by a national aristocracy of tough, mean, mainly warlords over the local war bands, who will impose neo-feudalism, not of Jews and non-whites and corrupted Uyghurs, but by those able to keep their followers fed and protected. In short, exactly the same thing which happened after the old kingdom of Egypt collapsed in 220 BC, like the Bronze Age collapse around 1200 BC, like when Rome fell in the 5th century BC or AD. So I don't know if I can read the entire thing because it's essay length here, okay? So I just want to cut to the end to see what you are saying here, Pastor. Will you go further down the road of Zogling, Uyghur dub, or choose to be the nonviolent moderate of what Z-Man calls our thing of white nationalism as it morphs back into overt white supremacy? I want you to stop denouncing lone tards, Dr. Greg. That's what I want from you. That and continuing to shit over the Zogbot Uyghur nationalists like Dickie Spencer and the rest of the Zog false flag nationalist 1.0 and 2.0 operations, which is leading the Zog-tarded Uyghurs in circles to keep them from stampeding and then turning feral. Hail victory. Okay, well, Pastor Lindstedt, I guess this is basically the same view that you've been holding for some time. My view about this is fairly simple. I don't think we get anywhere if we get taken off the air or thrown in prison. And that's kind of what I'm worried about, right? And so even if I believed the things that you believe, I wouldn't stand up on a soapbox, my little soapbox on the internet, and say that my solution is to let America fall apart, and then we will have 10,000 warlords, basically in a kind of Mad Max scenario, starting over with feudalism. And I especially am not going to say that, you know, lighten up on the lone tards that go off on shooting sprees. I'm sorry, I don't think that's particularly helpful. That's just an excuse, or that just gives the establishment, the state and big business and idiots who go along with what they want, excuses and pretexts for censoring us and deplatforming us. And my feeling is that our primary way of doing anything right now, our only way of doing anything right now, is to stay on the web and change people's minds. And if we can change enough people's minds, we don't need to seize the state, which is a topic that I talked about based on one of your questions of last time or a couple weeks ago. We don't need to seize the state. If we seize the minds of enough people, then the state will align itself with the minds of powerful people. And if we have enough people on our side, we're going to find that everybody in our pluralistic democracy suddenly treats white interests as sacrosanct, just like today they treat Jewish interests as sacrosanct. So that's how I look at my work. I don't know if America is going to collapse and we're going to go to feudalism and Mad Max and start civilization over again. It's a real possibility. It's nothing that I can plan on. It's nothing that I can really advocate. And I think that it's something that we should want to avoid. In the best case scenario, we should avoid the breakup of civilization. And I don't think there's anything wrong with me basically trying to stake out as reasonable and ethical a position as possible and paint a reasonable and ethical scenario by which we can achieve the ethnostate. I don't think there's anything wrong with me being the guy who does that, tries to lay out an image of the ethnostate as an ethical kind of solution to the problems of group conflict, basically, the problems created by globalization and multiculturalism, diversity. And then paint a picture of how we can get from here to there with as little upset, bloodshed, and violation of people's rights as possible. I think it's good to lay that all out. And a lot of people say, well, it's not realistic. And I just have to say, look, it might not be realistic. The world might not unfold the way I would like it to. In fact, it probably won't. Because one thing I've learned from history is that people seldom take the reasonable choice, the reasonable path. That doesn't mean, though, that we should basically just dispense with looking at rational and ethical alternatives to the mess that we're in. And I want to be the guy who does that. So that's my role. So I'm going to continue denouncing lone tards. And I will continue to shit over the Zogbach Wigger nationalists, as you describe them, like Dickie Spencer and the rest of them, when they do dumb stuff, which is frequent. So I will continue to do that, but I'm not going to stop denouncing lone tards. I'm not going to stop denouncing wildcat violence and so on and so forth. And I'm not going to stop trying to lay out a reasonable, humane, and ethical path to the ethnostate. I think somebody's got to do it. I think I'm pretty good at it, so I'm going to continue to do that. Anyway, we have a nice donation here from John, $50. Can Trevor Lynch review Dark City? Trevor Lynch could. I am Trevor Lynch, if you don't know. That's one of my pen names. I will look into it. There's no reason why I can't look into it. I know I've heard of it. It's not ringing a bell for some reason, though. But I'll look into it. But $50 is a really good incentive to look into it, too. So thank you very much. Nicephorus writes in with $15. Tucker Carlson said recently that the policies of the Reconstruction era were harmful to the South. Not expecting you to agree with Tucker, but what are your thoughts on this and any further reading you can recommend? Well, yeah, the policies of the Reconstruction era were harmful to the South because they were meant to be harmful to the South. It was a punitive era. They were punishing the South, and this is why the South rose up. This is why you got the KKK and things like that, and the Southerners took back their society. So I certainly would agree with that, and it's not a terribly controversial historical claim. So Paul writes in with $10. Thank you very much. What are your thoughts on Karl Popper's paradox of tolerance? Paul, I don't know off the top of my head what the paradox of tolerance is. I've read it before, but if you could write in and tell me what it is, refresh my memory, then I could comment on it. But just saying Paradox of Tolerance by Karl Popper doesn't actually call anything to mind. So Gadius writes in with $20. Goad writes, the worst week ever, but in my opinion, January has been one of the best months ever. The Capitol and the Wall Street both got punched in the mouth. Yeah. I agree. It's, I think the worst week ever is a great meme. It's a great theme. It's a great feature. And yeah, every week, horrible stuff happens, right? And you can make a very strong case that every week is the worst week ever because just things keep going downhill. This is the Kali Yuga after all. However, the fact is that there were some great things that happened this month. Yeah, we did get a senile old codger and a crook inaugurated as president of the United States after a stolen election. And that's sort of a black pill. That's sort of a bummer, to be perfectly honest. However, we did see some good stuff. The Capitol riot, well, I mean, it was good and bad. I thought the optics were hilarious. I don't know if they should qualify as good optics, but they were hilarious optics. There's a really good piece by Robert Hampton called White Pills from the Capitol or something to that effect, which I think lays out a good case for why this event overall was a good thing. You know, I can't endorse bad optics or illegal behavior, but I can, as a commentator, stand back and say the beautiful outpouring of democracy and protest and civil disobedience, which should be sacred in our society, is something to applaud. If those people who did commit crimes should be punished, but those who just basically showed up and protested and gave their views, they shouldn't be punished. That's good work on their part. They should do that. That's part of being in a democracy. And the fact that this has been treated as quote-unquote insurrection, as a riot, as a coup attempt, and that there are crazy narcissistic dingbats like AOC going around saying that they were almost lynched and murdered, if only, right? I'm sorry, but there wasn't anything like that going on. It's a joke. It's an absurd joke. So the overreaction, the hysterical, frothing, terrified overreaction of these people is interesting. I think they have bad consciences, right? If you go around sort of jumping at shadows and thinking that angry mobs are coming after you, maybe that's a sign that you've got a bad conscience. Maybe on some level you think that maybe you deserve that. The panic, the fear, and was real. It was real. Now, a lot of the commentary since then has just been gaslighting and pretending to be a victim, right? Liberalism, modern slave morality basically prizes victimization, and it encourages people to weaponize victimization by pretending to be victims when they're actually not. That's the coin of the realm in society today. And so the most powerful people in America are now pretending like they were one that just a hair's breadth away, a few minutes away from being lynched. What victims they are. And it's Trump who's responsible. So they impeached the guy again over this. They're going to railroad a lot of these people. And I pity these people. I'm sorry that they're being railroaded. It's quite unjust. But it's incredibly educational. It's a terrible mistake that the establishment is making. A terrible mistake. And I'm glad they're making that mistake, because we're going to be pointing out that mistake for a long, long time, and it's going to bring more people around to our way of thinking. So yeah, this was a terrible own goal on their part. It was a minor event that was magnified into something that it wasn't. And the lies and the overreaction are seriously damaging the establishment. And I think that that's good, because we want maximum damage to the establishment. And it's just, it's a bonus when small stimuli like memes or, you know, what was it? A few dozen people doing unauthorized tourism and a couple of criminals. That's a small stimulus for an enormous meltdown, right? These people make it so damned easy for us. That's one of the things that we have to sit back and take stock of. A guy like Ricky Vaughn, who has been arrested for memes, made these people so angry with his smart alecky comments and funny pictures on Twitter that they fumed and schemed for 5 years to arrest the guy on bogus charges. That's fascinating. What multiplies our little barbs and memes into this kind of stuff, this kind of repression? Well, we're dealing with highly neurotic individuals here. Very fearful, highly neurotic individuals. And their neurosis is the multiplier that turns memes into insurrections and nervous breakdowns on their part. And they don't realize how much power that gives us over them. We have almost no power except our ability to make fun of them, but they're so glass-jawed and thin-skinned and hypersensitive and guilty that and neurotic that the smallest of stimuli can create enormously disproportionate, crazed responses that are self-refuting. These people are throwing their credibility on a bonfire. It's like a potlatch ceremony where these people have gone mad. They're dancing around a bonfire and throwing their credibility on it. And they're so arrogant, they don't even see that. This is why in the last 5 years, the level of trust in the establishment, especially the establishment press, has been collapsing. They're so neurotic. They have little control. They cannot help themselves, right? And so they go mad when we just make the slightest little stimuli because they're so spoiled. They're so spoiled, overly sensitive, and neurotic. So anyway, the other thing about this month, yeah, that's been fantastic is the short squeeze. This is a beautiful thing, and we're going to talk about this for a whole hour. So I'll just wait till then, and we can get into this more later. So I'm going to go back over to DLive and see if there are more questions. Okay, nothing there. And somebody has sent me a message explaining the paradox of tolerance by Karl Popper. Should a tolerant society tolerate intolerance? It's a paradox, but unlimited tolerance can lead to the extinction of tolerance. If we tolerate people, you know, saying bad things, then Nazis, then we'll lose tolerance. Okay, so any movement that preaches intolerance and persecution must be outside of the law. I mean, just I'm reading this text. I'm not quite sure. So as paradoxical as it may seem, defending tolerance requires us not to tolerate the intolerant. Okay, well let's just go back on you. If you don't tolerate the intolerant, then you're not tolerant, and so we shouldn't tolerate you, right? We shouldn't tolerate Karl Popper and all these liberals and these Antifa types. And the thing that's hilarious is they immediately go to the Nazis, right? They say, if only they had not tolerated the Nazis, so much terrible stuff could have been avoided. So therefore, we should not tolerate that. We shouldn't make the mistake that the Weimar Republic made of tolerating the Nazis. Well, that's just historically counterfactual. That's just false. The Weimar Republic was constantly engaged in attempts to penalize, censor, repress, slander, etc., the Nazi Party. The government was doing it, and of course, private entities, other political parties, their newspapers, the press in general, were engaged in this. They were being constantly boycotted, which was just the earliest form of deflatforming. Their meetings were broken up. They were constantly being persecuted by their political enemies. What did that do? What did that accomplish? What did all that intolerance of the National Socialists accomplish? Well, it impeached the liberals who claimed that they were paragons of tolerance, and when it was obvious that they weren't. Here's the thing. If liberalism and tolerance is actually going to happen, then self-proclaimed liberals have to practice what they preach. And if you notice that no liberal actually believes in tolerance of ideas that they don't agree with already, and we don't have to tolerate ideas that we agree with, right? We agree with them, so we don't suffer them. Tolerance really means being willing to put up with the expression of ideas that profoundly offend you. That's what it means. It doesn't take any effort to hear stuff that you want to hear. It takes effort to hear stuff you don't want to hear, right? If no liberals actually practice tolerance, then people out in the public who hear, you know, the idea of tolerance batted around from time to time, whenever it's convenient, right? They're just going to stop listening to that. Also, when you persecute people, and people are willing to put up with persecution because they strongly believe in what they're doing, that gives them credibility. So all the intolerance that was directed at the National Socialists in Germany backfired. It backfired in the sense that it impeached the credibility of liberals, made them hypocrites, revealed them as hypocrites, because they didn't practice tolerance. Also, communists were militantly intolerant, and liberals would be militantly intolerant of the National Socialists and mysteriously quiet about the communists, which impeached their credibility even more. And by persecuting people, you bring attention to them. And if they stand up to persecution, they gain credibility. They gain man points, right, in the eyes of people. If you are persecuted and you stand up for yourself, if you go, you take up arms against all of these persecutors and people who mock you and so forth, that gives you credibility. People look at you and they think, maybe these people have something to say. I don't necessarily agree with what they say, but they sure seem sincere and are self-sacrificing. So, the Antifa lie that if only they had stomped out National Socialism and censored it, we would have saved so many lives. It's just a lie. It's just that. It's a big lie. It's a big dumb lie. Okay. And so these people who say that, absolute tolerance and freedom of speech should not include people who are against tolerance, right? That would include Karl Popper. He's against tolerance, right? He says there are limits to tolerance. We shouldn't tolerate the intolerant. Well, if we shouldn't tolerate the intolerant, we should burn Karl Popper's books, right? Let's burn Karl Popper's books. He's intolerant, and we shouldn't tolerate him by his own, principles. So I think that basically sums up my view about this particular guy and his particular paradox of tolerance. I've actually made a very, very strong argument for freedom of speech as a right. If people have freedom of speech as a right, that means that you tolerate views that you think are radically wrong and stupid. Okay. Now, does that include Marxism and stuff like that? Absolutely. I would have complete tolerance for people talking about that kind of stuff in society. I would not tolerate mafias of Marxists taking over institutions and turning them, towards propaganda purposes, which is basically all of higher education in America. Breaking up those mafias and getting those people's hands off positions of power and influence is not intolerance as I define it. That is actually creating an atmosphere where people can actually speak their minds rather than just Marxist propaganda, ultra-leftist propaganda. That, I think, is a way of gaining tolerance. So yeah, we should break up mafias that control academia and the media, so that that creates more tolerance, that creates more freedom of thought. But I believe in an absolute right to uphold crazy ideas. Why? Because every society depends upon the flow of accurate information to the top where people make decisions. If you have a society where accurate information does not reach the top and decision makers therefore cannot make rational decisions, that society lacks an absolutely necessary condition for self-preservation. How do you ensure that accurate information flows into the hands of decision makers who are powerful people, after all? How do you make sure that powerful people get the information that they need to make decisions? Well, if you have good news for powerful people, they love to hear good news, right? They absolutely love to hear good news. What powerful people don't like to hear is bad news. And often powerful people will try and punish you for bringing them bad news, or they will try and suppress bad news, etc. Sometimes they don't even do it consciously. They're just arrogant. They're impatient. They want to be flattered. They want to be confirmed in their worldview. But if you are surrounded by people who are only feeding you what you want to know, you're missing out on crucial information that you might need in order to survive. So leaders have to create an atmosphere of frankness around them, specifically frankness in bringing them bad news. How do you do that? Well, you basically make it a protected right, a politically protected right to say things that upset the people in power. That's what freedom of speech means, a right to say things that upset people in power. And someday people like us will be in power, and we're going to need that to hold on to that right. We're going to need to basically create a society where people dare upset us, because sometimes we might need to be upset, right? If we're going to survive, if we're going to correct dangerous problems and imbalances, dangerous situations. So anyway, that's a strong case for tolerance in a very strong sense. And that would include tolerance of the intolerant, right? That would include tolerance of idiots like Karl Popper or Marxists or George Soros, people like that. I want these people to feel free, if they think this nonsense in our society, to come forward and talk about it. I'd like to know who these people are, for one thing. And I would like it to be possible for, you know, them to sincerely protest if they think things are going in the wrong way. And we will make sure that people are educated well enough about history that they are inoculated against these dumb ideas going viral and destroying societies like they're destroying our society today. But yeah, so I'm a believer in strong tolerance, but I do think that in order to have a workable liberal society, what you really need to do is you have to have virtuous and well-educated people. Because if you don't have the state constantly controlling people's behavior, you have to have people controlling their own behavior. And one of the ways that people can control their own behavior, or that we can create people who are capable of functioning in a free society, is to give them a good education that inoculates them against these terrible mind viruses that are destroying our society today. That doesn't mean that we censor people and suppress them. In fact, I want everybody to know all about Marxism in the ethnostate. I want them to know the truth about Marxism so that when somebody pops up and says, what about from each according to his ability to each according to his need, people can say, well, you know, that idea has been debated and found wanting. Do you want to know why? And it just won't take off like it's taken off and ruined our society today. So I think that pretty much covers Popper on tolerance. I would certainly, if you take Popper seriously, what that means is you would have to not tolerate Karl Popper, right? If being completely tolerant of radical ideas, including intolerant ideas, is self-defeating, then what you have to do is censor intolerant people. Popper himself is arguing for intolerance, so Popper himself is arguing for censoring his own ideas. I think that's a kind of higher order Popper paradox of intolerance. So let's see if we have some other questions here at Entropy. Alrighty, Unknown Californian writes in with $20. I'm not sure how to feel about whites who are the offspring of people who emigrated to the United States in the early 20th century. When asked about the Confederate statues coming down, they say they have no connection to it. They may even say they have no connection to the founding fathers. What are your thoughts on these people? Okay, I don't object to immigration from racially and culturally compatible people in small numbers if they are assimilated into our culture. And the people who in America today descend from, say, Ellis Island immigrants, and they say, I'm sorry, I just don't feel any connection to the war between the states. I don't feel any connection to the Revolutionary War, etc. Well, they represent a failure of assimilation. And that is a problem. We have failed to assimilate these people because even because it is possible to identify with the founders and with the war between the states and with American history as a whole, even if you came or your ancestors came relatively late. It's possible to do that. So I think that we should simply chalk that up to a failure of assimilation and leave it at that. And there's really nothing more to say about that. So if our immigration and naturalization system worked well, Italian Americans whose ancestors all arrived in the 1890s would, first of all, they'd know a lot about American history. They would feel like they are part of the American polity, the American nation, the white American nation, I should say. And although they wouldn't have any Confederate ancestors or ancestors who fought in the Revolutionary War, things like that, they'd still feel some connection to that. That, I think, would be a good thing, and that is something to be aimed at. Of course, the group that has the least connection to anything in American history is Jews, right? And there was a wonderful comment from Gore Vidal. I think he was referring to Norman Potteritz and his wife, who basically said that the Civil War was as irrelevant to them as the Wars of the Roses, right? They're just being honest, right? But what they were indicating, according to Vidal, was that they had no intention of becoming assimilated Americans. They were a group unto themselves, a nation unto themselves, Jews, and that's what they wanted to remain. It is possible for Ellis Island types to identify with the American polity and its history. If you're from a European country, you know, you're not that different from Americans anyway. And if you assimilate into America, you're going to understand American history. It's going to affect you because you're part of the polity. And therefore, even though your ancestors weren't there, it still affects your life. It affects how you live today. So I do think that that is a way of looking at this. I certainly don't want to say that we should disqualify people who came rather late to America from thinking of themselves and speaking as Americans. In fact, the problem here is the failure of that to happen, the failure of our assimilation, our education, the ability to make these people part of our polity. But it is possible for that to happen. Again, it takes effort. It shouldn't be done with large numbers of people. It should be done with small numbers of people. We should be selective about who comes in. Being of the same race is basically the outer boundary of assimilability, and we should try and get as similar as possible within those wide boundaries. And that's about it. So there's another question here too, from Unknown Californian. So let me go into that one. He writes in with $5. Again, thank you very much. Any thoughts on people pushing third position politics who also favor segregation for those who want it and civic nationalism? Living in hyper-diverse California, I just want these people to move back to their homelands. Okay, I need to think about this. People pushing third position politics who also favor segregation for those who want it and civic nationalism. Well, I guess what that would be is something like, well, what I call in one of my essays, 90% white nationalism, right? The cultural chauvinism of somebody like Gavin McGinnis. Gavin McGinnis doesn't want to create a white ethnostate. He just wants to have a society that's normatively white, and that where the non-whites who are part of that society accept white norms. Okay. That would be better than what we have now. That's what we used to have. And I guess the question is, why not accept that as opposed to go into the ethnostate? Well, my thinking about this is kind of nuanced, so give me a couple minutes here. I have an essay called The Uppity White Folks Manifesto. It's at Countercurrents, where I talk about this. I think the civic nationalist position, where you try and demand that we have a normatively white society where the society works for the interests of the founding population in America, that's white people, the people who created the state, who created the society, even though there might be other groups involved in the society, is a legitimate interim position. Okay, I think that is a completely conceivable position to advocate today, because we know that there are large numbers of white people who are ready for some form of white identity politics, but they're not ready for the ethnostate. They think that whites have an identity, they're proud of whiteness, they're proud of their identity, they think their race is a good thing, they feel like they're being penalized in the current system, and they think it's permissible for whites to organize to protect their interests in this multicultural system. But if you start saying, well, we should just send all of these people away or partition the country and have none of them around, they think, wait, that's a little LARPy. We're not ready for that. So I wanted to lay out something that they are ready for, and I call it 90% white nationalism. I say, why don't we just have ethnic policies, immigration and naturalization policies that aim at returning to the ethnic status quo of 1965. The 1924 immigration restriction legislation was based on the maintaining the ethnic status quo based on the 1890 census. So we've had laws like this before. Why not treat 1965, the year that we opened the floodgates of the Third World, which was a terrible mistake, why don't we try and erase that terrible mistake and try and go back to status quo 1965 or some semblance of it. Some semblance of it meaning a 90% white society with a place for various non-white groups who are here, right? If we advocated that, a lot of white people would get on board with that. And a lot of non-whites would be on board with that because they don't want to live in a third world country. And they know that that's what's waiting for them if white dispossession continues. A lot of non-whites are on our side. Honestly, they wanted to come to a quote-unquote white supremacist society, a normatively white society, to escape the shitholes that they came from. And they don't want more and more people coming from those societies and basically turning America into simulacrums of the messes they escaped from. So we would actually get some of the non-whites on our side too. And we'd say, okay, let's just basically fix our immigration and naturalization standards such that we will slowly move back to a 90% white society, which is normatively white for 100% of the people who live in it, meaning that white standards of behavior apply. That is an appealing option to a lot of people. A lot of Americans, white Americans, who are ready for white identity politics but not ready for white nationalism would go for that. And I think that that would be a good thing. If we could get people going for that, that would represent a huge move in the right direction away from republicanism, right? Which would never entertain any of these ideas. They are absolutely convinced that the worst possible thing in the world is nationalism and identity politics for white people only. Everybody else, it's fine, but not for whites. That is the dogma that unites the entire political establishment. The GOP won't cross that line, but many, many white people are willing to cross it. And that kind of view is something a lot of whites would go for. So I think that that would be a good first step away from GOP race-blind politics towards a kind of white identity politics that would move in the right direction. Now, let's say that we had a 50-year project of getting back to the status quo 1965, ethnically. Well, I'd be dead by the time that happened, and I would hope that there'd be people who are trying to move the goalposts further in the direction of the ethnostate. I don't think that it's a bad idea, though, to have a reasonable interim position that people can gather around and move things in the right direction. But ultimately, ethno-nationalists will have to continue trying to move the goalposts in the direction of the ethnostate if we're ever going to get there. So I think that basically wraps things up for the AMA. I just want to make sure there are no more questions in the entropy stream, and I will check and see if there are any more questions at DLive. So let me just run through this quickly. What is a white nationalist 2.0 regime going to do with the non-whites and Jews? Well, we would hope that some of them would, if they're very uncomfortable dealing in a normatively, living in a normatively white society where whites are looking out for our own interests and asserting ourselves again, they can go somewhere else. And we would encourage them to do that, basically. So we would hope that that would take care of them. Now, with certain groups like Black Americans, there are large numbers of Blacks in America. I do like the idea of creating a Black homeland in America. As for recent immigrants from, say, south of the border, I think a lot of those people should just go back. Okay. As for Amerindians, well, they were here first, and I do think that that matters, and fairness would demand that we give them their reservations. They have their reservations. They have their casinos. They have their tax-free cigarettes, and so on. And let them just continue with that sort of situation. It's the maximum amount of autonomy that they can really have, given their tiny numbers and the fact that they're scattered around in the midst of America. So that's basically what I would say about that. The 90% white nationalist solution would move these people towards separating and going to their ethnostates. But some of them would remain. Whereas 100% white nationalist solution would basically involve things like partitioning off parts of American territory, and saying, this is Wakanda, right? This is Blacktopia or whatever. So I do think that that is a possibility as well. But these are things that can be debated two generations hence, if we get things moving in the right direction. And that's why I do think that people who want to entertain the idea of 90% white nationalism or just white identity politics in a multicultural society with a commitment to making sure that whites maintain a supermajority and that everybody accepts the normative whiteness of the social order would be a good interim thing. So I think that's really does it for the questions.